Archive on 4, Michael Sheen looks back at classic productions of Hamlet and at the many different interpretations of every actor's most coveted role in playing the Dane.
To be or not to be, that is the question.
Frailty, thy name is Woman.
Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio.
From this time forth, my thoughts be bloody.
The plain's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king.
There is a dark, spectral presence roaming the battlements of my future. I know I must go to meet it, and the prospect is both thrilling and terrifying. And it is also a phantom that casts a very long shadow. In autumn 2011, I begin rehearsals for Hamlet at the Young Vic in London with director Ian Rickson. Not another Hamlet, I hear you groan, as you tick off the Hamlets of recent years, Rory Kinnear, John Sim, Jude Law, David Tennant. Is it possible, Mr. Sheen, that you can bring anything new to such a well-worn role? But bear with me, and perhaps over the course of this program, as we listen to the rich archive of recorded Hamlets from Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree in 1908 to David Tennant in 2008, I'll be able to persuade you that this really is the most infinite of roles. Theatre critic Michael Billington certainly thinks it is, and I hate to think how many to-be-or-not-to-bes he's had to sit through in his long career.
I've always taken as my text for Hamlet something Oscar Wilde said in The Critic as Artist. He said, in point of fact, there is no such thing as Shakespeare's Hamlet. There are as many Hamlets as there are melancholies. And I think Wilde is making a fairly profound point there. He's saying Hamlet, of all Shakespeare's roles, is the one that depends most on the temperament and individuality of the actor. In other words, Hamlet seems to be an exercise in self-revelation. And that's why people often say, you know, there is no such thing as a bad Hamlet.
The received wisdom is that you don't play Hamlet, he plays you.
John Sim, who has recently been playing Hamlet at the Sheffield Crucible.
When they cast you as Hamlet, I think half the reason that they cast the person they do is because they want his personality. They want that actor to be Hamlet.
Everybody who plays Hamlet does bring it to themselves to some extent. You have to be what you really are.
John Gielgud, reflecting on the experience of playing Hamlet. There probably isn't any actor who hasn't fantasized about playing this most enigmatic and infinitely malleable of roles. The story goes that when actors reach a certain age and haven't played Hamlet, they wake up one morning and say, "I shall never play the Dane." In terms of lines, it is the longest part that Shakespeare wrote, a mouth-parching 1,495 lines. But it's also a role in which it's almost impossible not to feel haunted by the ghosts of Hamlet's past. Rory Kinnear is currently playing Hamlet in Nicholas Heitner's production at the National Theatre in London.
There are any number of ghosts in this play, and no one can really start rehearsals with a clean slate. But you sort of have to be rigorous about pursuing a clean slate. And there are certain moments where you realise you're chuntering along the train tracks that other people have set down. If you are going to do that, make sure it's right for your production and your Hamlet.
Telling that story night after night is tough, and yet continually surprising and rewarding. And it just feels like such an honour, really.
Hamlets have been short, like David Garrick, tall, like David Warner, on the larger side, like Simon Russell Beale, and on the thinner and more angular side, like Jonathan Pryce. Muscular, like Albert Finney, handsome, like Laurence Olivier. Exceedingly young, like William Henry West Betty, who first played the role at 13. And surprisingly old, like Thomas Betterton, who was still playing the role at 74. There have been female Hamlets, black Hamlets, Asian Hamlets, pastoral comical, historical pastoral, tragical historical, tragical comical historical pastoral Hamlets. The possible interpretations of the role appear to be inexhaustible. Paul Prescott is Associate Professor of English at the University of Warwick and a specialist in Shakespearean performance history.
The first performance would have been in or around 1600 at the Globe Theatre. Alas, we don't know an awful lot about it. We don't know what date it happened on, for example. It was obviously popular immediately. Other plays reference it and parody it. When Richard Burbage, who was the first Hamlet, died, epitaphs and poems and elegies mention his Hamlet. It was clearly a smash hit from day one.
Tradition has it that Shakespeare himself played the ghost performance, which is a nice idea, but one that is only based on hearsay from later sources. The play has been in continuous performance except during the time of Oliver Cromwell, when all the theatres were closed, which means that the role of Hamlet is part of a very long tradition, handed down from actor to actor.
There are various myths of so-and-so coaching so-and-so, who was taught by so-and-so, who studied under Burbage and so on. There's things like the bequeathing of Edmund Kean's sword down the lines of actors. So actors themselves are very conscious of this genealogy. And when John Gielgud wrote his notes on the play, he indeed called those notes the Hamlet tradition.
When I first played Hamlet, I never expected to be successful in it because I'd brought myself up on all the descriptions of other actors. I'd seen it 7, 8, 10 times before when I was young. I devoured everything about Irving, and I thought, well, I shall just go on and give a lot of cliches and imitations of things that I think Hamlet ought to do. But in some strange way, I remember it very well. At the first performances, I had a kind of feeling when I began to play it that there was only my own way to do it, and I kind of found the part as I went along in a very strange and sincere way, which I'd really never done before in acting. And I think I found for the first time a way to communicate my own feeling to the audience because it was so very strong. And it wasn't the feeling I had expected from seeing the play or from rehearsing it.
Both the character of Hamlet and the drama itself contain a huge variety of moods and textures. The play begins with a scene of high tension that takes place at the dead of night on the battlements of the castle at Elsinore. The castle guards have twice witnessed a supernatural visitation, a ghost, who is the spitting image of Hamlet's dead father, the last king of Denmark, who died some 2 months earlier. Here's a BBC radio production of Hamlet from 1948, which starred John Gielgud.
Midnight, on the battlements of the Royal Danish Castle of Elsinore. Francisco, a gentleman of the guard, is at his post.
Who's that?
Nay, answer me. Stand and unfold yourself.
Long live the king!
Hamlet is a play of shocks and surprises.
Look, where it comes again. In the same figure. Like the king that's dead.
And the character of Hamlet, the most important thing seems to me that he is a simple character, which really all Shakespeare's great heroes are, that he is put in an impossible predicament before the play begins, or at least as soon as we see him, and that he finds his way to his appointed fate through a series of episodes which we see before us, some of which we only hear about, but most of them we see in the play. And his character develops in a very natural way, but in a very surprising way to himself and to the audience.
After the supernatural drama on the battlements, we are transported to the court of Elsinore and our first glimpse of Hamlet and of his uncle, the new King Claudius. Following the death of his brother, Claudius has taken the throne and married Gertrude, his brother's widow and Hamlet's mother. Here's Patrick Stewart as Claudius and David Tennant as Hamlet.
Our cousin, Hamlet, and our son.
A little more than kin and less than kind.
How is it that the clouds still hang on you?
Not so, my lord. I am too much of the sun.
But as well as introducing us to our hero, this scene is vital in establishing the world of Elsinore itself and the state of Denmark. In Nicholas Heitner's 2010 staging at the National Theatre, Denmark is a place of surveillance and fear, in which security guards hover menacingly in the background. Rory Kinnear plays Hamlet in that production.
It does have this air of a thriller about it, as well as a psychological drama. And this production is very much about the state, a sense of being watched. I guess that sense that most of the drama and the scenes are overlooked by security or some members of the state makes the openness of the soliloquies all the more surprising.
A similar culture of state surveillance was adopted by actor-director Kenneth Branagh in his 1996 film of Hamlet, in which the set design made use of a great hall of mirrors. Theatre critic Michael Billington.
I mean, the film, I think, is a very fine film, really, because what it does is present us not just with Hamlet, but with Elsinore. Elsinore as a place of mirrors, a palace full of spies, eavesdropping, subversion. It's giving Elsinore a context, which, of course, film can do more clearly than theatre.
166, take 7.
I don't know why, really, I was so caught with the idea of using lots of mirrors. It's evocative of lots of things. As soon as I saw them, I thought of two-way mirrors, and I don't know why, I don't know what they said about me. Also, it speaks, if there are lots of them, of a certain amount of vanity and of people forever being watched or forever watching themselves. And I suppose in a sort of naff symbolic way, Hamlet is going through the play, looking at himself, discussing himself.
Kenneth Branagh talking from the set of his 1996 film. But this political interpretation of Hamlet is not a recent invention, nor indeed a British one. The tumultuous political climate of the early 20th century led to productions that foregrounded the political themes of the play. In 1926, Leopold Jesner directed a production at the Berlin Staatstheater, which portrayed Claudius's court as a parody of the corruption of the court of Kaiser Wilhelm.
Hamlet becomes political the further you get from our comfortable social democratic world. I mean, there was a famous Romanian production with an actor called Ion Caramitru, who I think is now part of the government in Romania, and he played Hamlet as the sole figure of truth in a sort of dusty, crumbling, dilapidated regime, in other words, the Ceausescu regime. Hamlet becomes a way of protesting about the current society.
To what issue will this come? Something is rotten in the state of Denmark.
But despite the larger political themes of the play, some productions have chosen to focus on the psychology of Hamlet himself and on the relationships within the royal family.
It is night. Hamlet, Horatio, and Marcellus are on the battlements.
We then go back to the battlements, and Hamlet is waiting for the ghost. The ghost appears quite different to the way he expected. He is so like his father in real life that he is again shaken to the core by this. And we have the great scene when the ghost tells him of Claudius's treachery.
Look, my lord! It comes!
Angels and ministers of grace, defend us.
In 1980, against the backdrop of Margaret Thatcher's first year in power, a young Jonathan Pryce played Hamlet at London's Royal Court Theatre, directed by Richard Eyre.
I mean, we had a lot of suggestions of the corridors of power, and it was referred to as quite a political production. But I approached it from a very personal point of view.
And what Jonathan Pryce brought out was the demonic and tormented nature of Hamlet. And most famously, of course, there was no ghost. What Jonathan Pryce did was to wretch up the ghost from his own innards, actually, and produce the ghost's voice from inside himself.
I am my father's spirit, doomed for a certain term to walk the night.
When Jonathan Pryce played Hamlet, he was grieving for his own father, who had died after being violently attacked in his grocery store by a teenage robber.
It was, for me, very Hamlet like in that I knew of the young person who'd attacked my father and hit him across the head. And I remember not feeling any anger or desire for revenge, although people all around me were. And the relationship I'd had with my father as a recalcitrant teenager, it was quite difficult. I loved him, he loved me, but we didn't have a great close relationship, or at least a verbal close relationship. And then when he died, I felt I'd absolutely missed this opportunity to have this relationship with my father. And I began to kind of conjure him up in my head. And there was a time when I was in a garden of the house we had at the time, and I thought I'd seen my father standing there looking at me. And I felt it was so much wish fulfillment that I wanted to see him and I wanted to talk to him. So that when we came to talking about the ghost and Richard saying that he wanted to make it as exciting and as frightening for a modern audience as it would have been when it was first performed. And then we started thinking of images from films and we thought of The Exorcist. He's rather funny now. But I put the idea of the girl in The Exorcist who was possessed by an evil spirit, that Hamlet would be possessed by the spirit of his father.
If ever thou did thy dear father love,
oh God,
revenge his foul and most unnatural murder.
It was very weird. It was almost like a ventriloquial act without the doll. But it was very powerful because it told you straight away that this Hamlet was a divided, tormented, and deeply disturbed man.
After his encounter with his father's ghost, Hamlet decides on the spur of the moment to adopt an antic disposition. By this means, he hopes to discover the truth about his father's death.
There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in our philosophy. But come here as before, never so help you mercy, how strange or odd soe'er I bear myself, as I perchance hereafter shall think meet to put an antic disposition on.
Kenneth Branagh from his 1992 radio production. Derek Jacobi, who has played Hamlet on stage and on television, also reflected on the prince's psychological state in a BBC radio essay from 1980.
Well, I don't think he's ever quite mad. The assumption of the antic disposition is initially to cloak his activities, or his detective work, if you like, to find out whether Claudius is really guilty and whether the ghost is a bona fide ghost or the devil in disguise. I think there are three moments when he gets himself into a dangerously traumatic state, moments when he does approach real madness, when he teeters on the very edge of insanity without quite going over. The first of these is, of course, with the ghost of his father, and then the scenes with the two women, with Ophelia in the nunnery scene and with his mother, Gertrude, in the closet scene. But for the rest of the time, he is eminently sane, with a razor-sharp mind, and with one quality that steers him away from insanity. Black, sardonic, sarcastic, ironic humour.
This is a quality of Hamlet's personality that is sometimes overlooked. His capacity for whip-smart and sometimes even vulgar humour.
The Queen, your mother, in most great affliction of spirit, hath sent me to you.
You're welcome.
Nay, good my lord, if it shall please you to make me a wholesome answer, I will do your mother's commandments.
Sir, I cannot.
What, my lord?
Make you a wholesome answer.
My wit's diseased.
My mother, you say?
I don't set out to particularly make it funny, and, well, you don't set out to do anything particular with it, you just set out to interpret the play, interpret the language and the character as seems fit and proper and truthful.
When Roscius was an actor in Rome...
The actors are come hither, my lord.
Buzz, buzz.
Upon mine honour.
Then came each actor on his ass.
I didn't play the humour very much.
Francis de la Tour played Hamlet at the Half Moon Theatre in London in 1979.
And I don't know whether I was frightened of it or whether it's because I thought it was a major tragedy, that because it was this great part. It's lonely looking back and seeing other productions of Hamlet that I realised how much humour there is. It was there, but if anything, I fought against it.
Do you know me, my lord?
Excellent, well. You are a fishmonger.
Richard Burton, on stage in 1964. In a radio programme from April 1954, the Irish actor Michael McLeamore, who had himself been a notable Hamlet, reflected on the cause of Hamlet's emotional state at this point in the play.
I do not think that Hamlet was, as many fine players seem to have believed, a born neurotic. I believe that his neurosis was circumstantial and not inherent. His glee, for example, at the arrival of any new distraction. Old friends who have come to visit him, the giving of jewels to a lonely girl, the coming of players to the court, the hearing of gossip from university or town, these things convinced me that though spiritually he was a drowning man, he had not thrown himself into the water. The water had flooded over him. I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth. And the fact that he had once possessed mirth helps me to prove a former statement about his melancholy being less inborn than circumstantial. But to seriously state that he is unaware why he lost it seems to me to undermine what has been so carefully built up in order to tell his story. And yet, how inexorably he reveals to us, for reasons sound or unsound, his wretchedness. I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, foregone all custom of exercise, and indeed it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory, this most excellent canopy, the air. Look you, this brave o'erhanging firmament, this majestical roof, fretted with golden fire, why it appears no other thing to me but a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors.
What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust?
Derek Jacobi. Hamlet is also one of the most self-consciously theatrical of all Shakespeare's plays. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern wake Hamlet out of his quintessence of dust reverie when they tell him that his favourite actors, the tragedians, are on their way to Elsinore.
Welcome all! I am glad to see thee well!
Welcome, good friends! Hey!
Hamlet is immediately reinvigorated and, somewhat presumptuously, instructs the actors in the art of speaking. One imagines Prince Charles might get short shrift for such interference.
The next reference to the actor's art is Hamlet's advice to the players, written obviously by an actor who has complete command of his calling.
One of the most highly regarded Hamlets of the 19th century came right at the end of it, an actor called Johnston Forbes Robertson.
Speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly, on the tongue.
Forbes Robertson was at the age of 44 when he first played Hamlet.
Paul Prescott.
He gave us Hamlet in 1897, and in a sense we can see it as partly a reaction against Irving's own style of delivery. Henry Irving was notorious for inserting odd and quite interesting pauses in his delivery of the verse. He also had a very distinctive voice, Irving did. It was hard, caustic, clipped, barbed, and so on. It was once described as like a jet of carbolic acid. Now, listening to Forbes Robertson is much more like being dipped in Horlicks.
Oh, to hear a robustious, periwig-pated fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, to split the ears of the groundlings, who for the most part are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise.
There's a surprising geniality about the way he approached the role. This was not a melancholy or neurotic Dane. This was someone who was almost avuncular, and I think the avuncularness, as it were, comes from the fact that he was slightly older even than when he first played the role, when he recorded it. But there is something surprisingly genial about his delivery here.
For anything so overdone is from the purpose of playing, whose end, both at the first and now, was and is to hold, as 'twere, the mirror up to nature.
Johnston Forbes Robertson, from a recording of 1928. A number of actors and directors have taken Hamlet at his word and used the play to mirror the times. In 1963, the new National Theatre opened on London's South Bank with a production of Hamlet, directed by Laurence Olivier. It starred Peter O'Toole, who was hailed as a beatnik Hamlet, an Elizabethan Jimmy Porter. Then, in 1965, Peter Hall directed a popular production of Hamlet at the RSC, which captured something of the youthful, revolutionary spirit of the times, with David Warner in the lead.
David Warner, I think, was 24 when he played it, and he was tall and wore this very long, drooping scarf that seemed to come down to his knees or below, and slightly scruffy, and he looked like a disordered and neurasthenic student. And given the 1960s, the auditorium was suddenly packed with disordered and neurasthenic students who found in David Warner an echo of their own uncertainty, insecurity about who they were and where they were going, etc. It was a classic performance, really, because it just seemed to embody in the most uncanny way the spirit of the times. And I think it was a turning point because it meant after Warner, there was no sort of set tradition. The romantic tradition was exploded at that moment.
Here's David Warner being interviewed by the BBC in 1966.
When I started to play the part, I didn't really think of it in terms of being a something of our time. It was something that I was playing the part, and it was for me, which happens to have become or labelled, I mean, people are very fond of using labels, a symbol of the time, contemporary, controversial, undergraduate, all these things, which I never thought about at all. It's just, for me, playing it, and obviously for Peter Hall, the natural thing at this moment to do.
Well, it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them.
And what about that speech? How can the actor's heart fail to clatter as he steps forward to begin?
To be or not to be?
That is the question.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune,
or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them.
To sleep. No more. And by sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to.
'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished.
To die. To sleep. To sleep. Perchance to dream.
Aye, there's the rub.
For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause.
You heard there Derek Jacobi, Kenneth Branagh, John Gielgud, Laurence Olivier, David Tennant, Rafe Richardson, Leslie Howard, and Jeremy Brett. Oh, and some bloke called Michael Sheen. In fact, our earliest extant recording of any Hamlet, and of any to be or not to be, is that of Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree from 1908. Paul Prescott of Warwick University.
Herbert Beerbohm Tree was a fascinating character, possibly the last of the great actor managers. He was synonymous with spectacle. He famously furnished his Midsummer Night's Dream with real rabbits. And one wag quipped when we watched his As You Like It that you couldn't see the Forest of Arden for the Beerbohm trees. He was criticised for, in effect, ignoring the verse and for paying far too much attention to display and externals. One of the things you notice listening to the recording is that it's remarkably slow. With all of these recordings, we should be wary of treating them as if they were actually how the actor said them on stage, of course. But nevertheless, this might give us some indication of Beerbohm Tree's, let's say, eccentricity. And the opening of To Be or Not To Be is rather ponderous and almost sepulchral.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them.
And as a point of comparison, you might compare it with the live recording of, say, David Warner in the 1960s.
For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life.
Well, I do remember Warner sort of addressing us with To Be or Not To Be as if he was somehow trying to work it out with us. I mean, he seemed to acknowledge the audience as if saying, well, What do I do? Do I continue? Do I kill myself? Where do I go from here? And it was as if all his confusion was suddenly apparent in that moment.
The To Be or Not To Be soliloquy, which is quite ambiguous. If you break it down line by line, it's quite difficult to pin down exactly what that means.
David Tennant, who played Hamlet for the RSC in 2008.
He's contemplating suicide because it would be so much easier to be dead than to be living through this hell he's found himself in. And yet he's haunted by this notion that there is an afterlife, that there is a final judgment that he will have to be accountable to.
It's a huge one, that. I liken the whole process of playing him over the last few times I've done it to being in the Grand National. It's one massive hurdle after another. And as John Nettle said yesterday, he said, to be or not to be is Beecher's Brook. But I don't think it's the hardest soliloquy by any means. It's musing on life and death. And the language is so beautiful in all of the soliloquies, in fact, throughout all the play, that all you really have to do is say it. But it's strange to walk on and say to be, and you can just feel the audience think, oh, here we go. And you really can't get the lines wrong because most people know it. But I just have to treat it as, you know, as happening in real time and not worry about it too much, or else I would indeed go mad.
Two recent Hamlets, David Tennant and John Sim, on the six most famous words in theatre. And what about the language of the play? Peter O'Toole, speaking in 1966.
You don't have to think. You think after the line.
Yes.
Not before it or not during. The line is the thought. This is the point of iambic pentameter.
Absolutely.
Very, very well put.
Absolutely true.
One has to come up against this. Of course, it's a play in verse. And what you crave in Hamlet is an actor whose voice can match the verse.
Michael Billington.
And, I mean, again, some are born to it and some achieve it. Michael Pennington, another great verse speaker. Derek Jacobi, another brilliant verse speaker, who I think made Hamlet one of his own best parts, actually. I mean, Gielgud, I never saw Gielgud play it, but you only got to listen to Gielgud on record. And it is just brilliant, actually, because he seizes on certain words like puzzles the will and just guides you beautifully through the sort of music of the speech, as well as giving us the intellectual idea behind it.
Who would fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns, puzzles the will, and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of.
One of the things we tend to forget about Hamlet is that it's only very recently that actors have only just had one bite of the cherry, as it were. For the majority of theatre history, an actor, and this began with Burbage, would have the chance to play the part over and over again over the course of many years. So, for example, David Garrick in the 18th century played Hamlet for over 34 years. Thomas Betterton played the part for nearly 50 years. This is astonishing. Possibly the last great actor to have this relationship with the play was John Gielgud. And John Gielgud is in many ways the definitive Hamlet of the 20th century, partly because he had the chance to revisit the role in a number of productions over the course of 16 years. Gielgud was someone who could speak clearly and often very beautifully as quickly as Hamlet thinks, which is a very rare capacity in an actor.
Another natural verse speaker was Richard Burton, who played Hamlet at the Old Vic in 1954 and then again in New York in 1964, directed by John Gielgud. Gielgud reflected on the experience in 1984.
I called him the Shropshire Lad Hamlet. He was a very extrovert. He had a wonderful way with the verse. I mean, it poured out of him with great ease.
But the production had its critics, John Gielgud among them.
I wasn't very happy with the production. I didn't think I did a good job on it. He was very sweet and very agreeable. He'd played it before at the Vic. But I found it a little difficult to know at rehearsals whether he was just going through it for the words or for the other actors, or whether he really wanted to change things or develop his performance very much. I told him the places to rest, which he said was a great help, rather than not to strain in certain scenes. And I could never get him alone. And he never seemed to want to rehearse very much, although he did so in a kind of very agreeable but rather casual way.
John Gielgud, who is the best director I've ever worked with on the stage, certainly, was marvellously instructive about Hamlet. but certainly he didn't dominate in the sense of saying, you must do this, or you must do that, or you must go there, and you must do... Because there were certain stern rules that I had for myself. A, don't come near me. You leave me alone. Which he understood. And I think he thinks that I'm a very undisciplined actor. For that very reason, I have to have a lot of space on the stage, a lot of space that I can move without being bothered by too many people. Well, John says I'm very undisciplined. He's probably right. But then I wouldn't want to be disciplined. I wouldn't want to be that kind of actor who goes on the stage and perfectly every night gives the same cadence to the same speech every night for days and days and days and days on end. I would prefer to be free so that I'm invited to be bad some nights. What a piece of work is a man. How infinite in faculty, in form, in moving, how express and admirable in apprehension, how like an angel in movement, how like a god, the beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust?
Anthony Quayle.
It is magical, his sense of rhythm and his sense of waiting for the truth, the inner truth within inside the verse, backed up with great magnetism, a great sexual magnetism, which anybody could feel. It didn't matter whether you were a man or a woman or anything, it was perfectly obvious.
As for the truth about Hamlet's sexual experience, we're only given a few clues in his scene with Ophelia, in which he famously tells her to get thee to a nunnery.
What I've noticed in my lifetime is a kind of growing feeling of rejection of Ophelia, frankly. And what I've noticed is Hamlet's cruelty, particularly in the Get Thee to a Nunnery scene, which seems to me now played more and more on a level of misogynist violence or sexual confusion, let's put it like that. Increasingly seems to be knock her about. I mean, that's what I've noticed, the violence, physical violence towards Ophelia.
Get thee to a nunnery, go, farewell, or if thou wilt need marry, marry a fool. The wise men know well enough what monsters you make of them. To a nunnery, go, and quickly do farewell.
Kenneth Branagh and Kate Winslet from Branagh's film of 1996.
Paralyzed as he is by his own, not his inability to decide, he decides the moment the ghost tells him what to do. He's unable to act. Means that he's searching in all sorts of ways for someone or something to blame, and two recipients of that blame, that hatred, are Gertrude and Ophelia, both who I suppose he may feel have rejected him. In the absence of something else to blame but himself, is then channeled into this incredibly vicious denunciation of the pair of them and woman in general. And it's, I suppose, one of the least appealing parts of his personality.
One Hamlet who did show great tenderness to Ophelia was Angela Winkler, the German actress who played Hamlet at the Edinburgh Festival in 2000.
And it was a rather drab production, as I remember it. It all was set against a sort of container truck. So there was nothing very beautiful to look at, but Angela Winkler, in the midst of this, brought out, I would say, the femininity of Hamlet. You ask if there's been a Hamlet that showed tenderness towards Ophelia. Yes, Angela Winkler, who showed grace and compassion and sympathy. I saw Frances de la Tour play it in London about 20 years before that, and she was very good indeed. But she almost went in the other direction, as if to say, well, I'm a woman playing Hamlet, therefore I'm going to try and emphasise his athleticism, his physical danger, his sudden bursts of frenetic anger and activity.
Frances de la Tour played the role at the Half Moon Theatre in London in 1979.
It can't be an accident that throughout history Hamlet has been played by women at various stages. And I think it is because it is such a universal youth, expressing all the emotions of youth and of life. And there isn't another part to match it.
The 18th century actress Sarah Siddons is the first known to have played Hamlet, and perhaps most famously, the 19th century French actress Sarah Bernhardt played Hamlet on stage and in a very early film of 1900, Le Duel d'Hamlet. Sarah Bernhardt described Hamlet as manly and resolute, but nonetheless thoughtful. He thinks before he acts. a trait indicative of great strength and great spiritual power. She later went so far as to say, I cannot see Hamlet as a man. The things he says, his impulses, his actions, entirely indicate to me that he was a woman. Whether or not you choose to define some aspects of Hamlet's behaviour as feminine, there have been a number of actors who have chosen to emphasise Hamlet's virility. John Barrymore was possibly one of the most successful American actors to tackle the role, not least because he had played the role in London in 1925 to great acclaim. Barrymore was from a great theatrical dynasty, one which continues today in the actress Drew Barrymore, who is John Barrymore's granddaughter.
Presenting John Barrymore, Crown Prince of the Royal Family of the American Theatre, as Hamlet, melancholy lover of Shakespeare's immortal drama.
Ladies and gentlemen, I feel quite sure that you're all so well acquainted with this famous soliloquy from Hamlet that any attempt at elucidation on my part, other than the soliloquy itself, might be justly considered a bit of impertinence. As you remember, it goes as follows.
Barrymore was a matinee idol, was incredibly famous, handsome, charismatic screen actor. And as with many screen actors taking on the Bard, he was anxious that he would not put a foot wrong and not be seen to be stupid and so on. So he paid an enormous amount of care and attention to the verse and to the individual words and really thought through this performance. It was an incredibly detailed and conscientious performance. Now that makes it sound slightly drab, and it was clearly anything but drab. At least three very important people saw Barrymore's Hamlet and were bowled over by it.
Orson Welles was a great admirer and considered it the best Hamlet he'd ever seen. Here he is discussing Barrymore in a 1963 BBC interview.
Who's the best Hamlet that you've ever seen? Is there such a thing?
Yes, yes, Barrymore.
Barrymore. He must have been a very princely Hamlet, Barrymore.
Not so much princely. He was a man of genius.
Yes.
Who happened to be a prince. And he was tender and virile and witty and dangerous.
The young John Gielgud and the young Laurence Olivier saw this performance of John Barrymore's in London in 1925. The young John Gielgud admires it for its tenderness and its remoteness and its neurosis, what we might call Gielgudian qualities. Olivier, on the other hand, wrote in retrospect, it was amazing. Everything about him was exciting. He was athletic. He had charisma. And Olivier particularly admired Barrymore's approach to the verse, in which Barrymore would choose a word and suddenly explode it in a moment of passion. So what's fascinating is that you get the young Gielgud and the young Olivier seeing very different things in this performance, and things which would indeed influence their own Hamlets.
Bloody bawdy villain. Remorseless. Treacherous. Lecherous, kindless villain, the vengeance!
John Barrymore was very conscious that he wanted Hamlet to be as manly as possible. He told a friend of his, I want him to be so male that when I come out on the stage, they can hear my balls clank. He thinks he doth protest too much, perhaps, but that gives you some sense of what he was after.
John Barrymore was also quite possibly the first actor to give Hamlet's relationship with his mother, Gertrude, a pointedly Freudian interpretation. Paul Prescott.
People usually describe Olivier as the first person to introduce the Oedipus complex into Hamlet. Now, this isn't actually true. Barrymore, in 1922, was convinced that the relationship between Hamlet and Gertrude explained rather a lot. Indeed, he described Hamlet later in life as a mother-loving pervert. The closet scene was played with what one might call excessive tenderness, featuring several passionate embraces and the laying of heads on laps and breasts and so on.
In 1937, Tyrone Guthrie directed Laurence Olivier in a Hamlet at the Old Vic, based on psychoanalyst Ernest Jones's theory that Hamlet's behaviour was rooted in the Oedipus complex. Here's Olivier himself, in an interview with Kenneth Tynan from 1966, talking about his 1937 production.
And although I will not go so far as to say that that's all the play is about now, I did in those days. I thought that that was the absolute resolution of all the problems concerning Hamlet, and it, for what little use it had, it at least gave one a central idea which seemed to fulfill the great vacuum provided by all the crossed ideas about Hamlet, what he really was, what he really wasn't, whether he's a man of action, whether he wasn't a man of action. Now, he could perfectly safely be a man of action under the auspices of that particular idea that he couldn't kill the king because, subconsciously, of course, couldn't kill the king because he was guilty himself. Now, although now, I think there are many more things in Hamlet than that, but I still would favor the idea that if there is such a thing as an Oedipus complex, which we know perfectly well there is, it was not entirely absent from the Royal Court of Denmark.
Olivier's 1948 film version retained these Oedipal overtones, casting 28-year-old Eileen Hurley as Gertrude, opposite the 41-year-old Olivier as her son.
Oh, shame, where is thy blush? If hell can rise up in a matron's bones to flaming youth, let virtue be as well.
Oh, Hamlet, speak no more.
One of the main challenges facing any actor who plays Hamlet is the huge range of moods and emotions that he encompasses. He is both a sweet-souled prince, but also a prince capable of killing. First Polonius, in a fit of rage, and then his former friends, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, after he learns that they have betrayed him.
Yes, you've got to bring out this sort of cruelty in Hamlet. I always think, now might I drink hot blood is one line. The other one is when he says of the corpse of Polonius, I'll lug the guts into the neighbour room. Now, how do you reconcile the sort of caring and compassionate Hamlet with I'll lug the guts into the neighbour room? And what the actor has to do is find within himself those contradictory resources, which I guess is why the part continues to attract actors and always will.
Kevin Kline has played Hamlet twice in the United States, in 1986 and again in 1990. This is Kline in an interview from 1994.
He will never be the same Hamlet he was before he killed Polonius. He goes to England and he kills his two old friends. He, granted, they were there to kill him, but he arranges very deftly to have them killed. So now he has the blood of three people on his hands. And in a way, he's now, sadly, ironically, ready to be a king.
This same skull, sir, was Yorick's skull, the king's jester. This. In that.
Let me see. Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio. A fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. He hath borne me on his back 1,000 times.
Laurence Olivier, from his film of 1948.
Well, Hamlet comes back from England into the graveyard. Determined, changed, calm, and has his scene with the gravediggers, in which he seems to be philosophical, whimsical, not worrying about the future very much, not disturbed as he was in the first part.
In 1954, John Gielgud reflected on a play that he had been intimately associated with since 1929.
And one has the feeling when he comes back in the graveyard scene that Hamlet has kind of got a breath of fresh air, had a holiday in some way, and that he comes back with all these problems settled in his mind. One longs to know what he said to Horatio and how they discussed what had been going on in his absence. Perhaps they didn't have very much time before they appeared.
The Act 5 Hamlet, he has a greater sense of the whole and a greater sense of calm.
Rory Kinnear.
I don't think dying is never, ever really the worry. I think it's living up to honour that is the worry for Hamlet.
And he agrees to the duel in the most curiously, almost not quite apathetic, but agreeable and charming way, and has a sort of feeling, well, maybe it's... He knows enough there's danger because he has these things about the fall of a sparrow and if it is now, it is not to come, and so on, that you feel he is aware of death, but you don't feel that he cares. It's as if he seemed to know, as people do sometimes, that they are reaching the point when they can put it into the hands of a higher power and that their life will be resolved in some way, which seems to make the last two scenes of the play, and tremendously touching and poignant, and not in the least sentimental.
It's interesting that one remembers the first Hamlets one saw more clearly sometimes than recent ones. I mean, the first great one I saw was at Stratford in 1958, and it was Michael Redgrave. And I've actually never seen a greater Hamlet than that. And where he was particularly magical was in that very last act when Hamlet comes back to Denmark, a changed character from the one we've seen in the first four acts, more settled, more composed, more resigned, I think, to his own fate. And he has that marvellous speech, which ends up with those two amazing words, "Let be," as if what will be, will be. And there was a kind of philosophical calm and beauty about Redgrave's performance at that moment that I've never, ever forgotten.
We defy augury. There's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. Since no man has aught of what he leaves, what is to leave betimes? Let be.
Despite Horatio's warning, Hamlet agrees to a duel with Laertes, not knowing that Laertes is fighting with a poisoned sword. Claudius and Gertrude watch. Claudius poisons a cup of wine with the intention of giving it to Hamlet, but Gertrude unsuspectingly drinks from it instead. Laertes wounds Hamlet, and in a scuffle, Hamlet takes Laertes' sword and cuts Laertes. The queen falls to the floor. Laertes confesses to his treachery and tells Hamlet that Claudius has poisoned both sword and cup. In a fury, Hamlet attacks Claudius with the poisoned sword and forces him to drink the remaining liquid in the cup. Kevin Kline.
The last scene, where all the threads sort of the action of the play come together in terms of, I mean, Hamlet dies, but first he kills Claudius, and then, of course, he's killed. Just when, in fact, he's sort of, he might be actually ready now to be a good king.
There's something pending in the duel scene. Something is going to happen, which the audience is supposed to feel. Hamlet instinctively knows. Claudius knows. Laertes knows.
David Warner.
And something does happen in the end.
I think the greatest theatrical effect comes when you die upon a laugh. When you say the rest is silence while you're laughing.
Yes, well, this is following through the logical progression of this particular interpretation. I mean, it's terribly ironical for Hamlet anyway, and the way he has abused people, should be being rude, nasty to people, and all this kind of thing, to suddenly find himself in a situation where what he's been trying to do for the whole of the last 4 hours of Hamlet is he does it in the end when he's dying. He knows he's dying, and he kills Claudius. Claudius dies, Laertes dies, the queen dies, Fortinbras comes, and he's just realized that he's the same as everybody, Hamlet. And it's terribly ironical and rather ridiculous, really. And he appreciates a situation that some audiences sometimes appreciate when they see, the audience sees, three or four dead bodies lying on the stage. It's rather funny. And Hamlet finds it funny. And my Hamlet does. All these people, and he's going to die anyway as well. You know, after all this time of soul-searching, indecision, he suddenly finds that when he's dying, then he can do the act. He can kill Claudius.
I think the hardest part is holding your breath after you die, because you're panting like mad after the sword fight, and and you're exhausted. And then you have these people talking over your body, and you're usually dead center stage, and everybody's, like it or not, looking to, he's breathing.
But despite the exceptional demands of the role, many actors find it very difficult to leave the part behind.
I remember on the last night, I could hardly get the words out because I couldn't believe that I was never, ever, ever going to say those lines again in the context of the play. I could read it, but it was really heartbreaking. It's the richest thing you could ever imagine doing, ever, on stage.
Perhaps more than with any other role, this is a part that plays you. Rory Kinnear.
When I first was asked about it, a lot of people would talk about it in negative terms, about it being a burden or about it being a great responsibility. I have to say, I never saw it like that, and I haven't felt hampered by the ghosts of Hamlet's past. Indeed, one is entirely liberated by them. It's a play that has been done before and will be done again. And so, to make it in the image of the age and body of the time, you have all your advice already written down from Shakespeare.
I think we have a plurality of Hamlets, actually, and I'm not sure one can discern yet a pattern, nor should we, perhaps. Any production of Hamlet, any performance of Hamlet, says something about the age in which one lives. And I would have thought we're living at a time of palpable economic uncertainty, moral confusion, religious scepticism. In other words, I think we're still searching to find out what kind of age we're living in and what kind of society we ideally want to create around us. I think Hamlet should embody the uncertainty or the nature of the age.
The richness of the archive suggests that Oscar Wilde was right. There are as many Hamlets as there are melancholies. When I begin to approach playing Hamlet myself next year, I suppose there's a few things that I'll be keeping in mind. I see the play as a sort of irritant in the mind of the Western psyche. It seems to be a play that takes place in a kind of hinterland between death and life, madness and sanity, being and not being. And so these questions are being grappled with by this man who fears that he's not equipped fully to be able to deal with them. I think it's the most dangerous play in the Western canon. And so I hope that when I start working on the play in earnest, that I'll have the courage to be able to go to the dark heart of the play. And I, for one, hope that we never get to the bottom of Hamlet.
Rest is silence.
Playing the Dane was presented by Michael Sheen. The programme was produced by Emma Harding. Moby Dick, it has...